and they were telling, look, it's horrible, I have no shoes on my feet, I cannot buy enough food for my children anymore, and the war is eating us up, and I've lost a son, and I lost a father, and especially the military draft. They all want to stop the military draft. They said, I don't want to let my son go into the army. Or the young boy said, I don't want to go into the army. And they all thought, we will never get rid of this war. We'll never get rid of the boycott of the United States if we do not change our government.
And then many mothers told me, who had been mother of a hero and martyr, so they had, one or two sons had been killed, or their husband, and they said, I gave my vote to UNO as a present to other mothers, so their sons will not be killed.
But they still support the goals and objectives of the Sandinistas.
But they voted for UNO.
All the way down from Esquipulas, where we were, to Managua, I asked him, I said, what are these happy victors? You know, they won the elections. Nobody was smiling, nobody was cheering. Everybody went on with stale faces, didn't talk to each other very much. All this animated discussion and goings on what you had before the election, it was suddenly died out. I cannot explain it.
Two people who have been to Nicaragua 3 times. The last one was an extensive visit during the elections. They'll share with us their experiences and insights from visiting people in the country and the cities, the people in the streets, and the top administrators in the government. Right now on Alternative Views. Many of the guests we've had on Alternative Views have been to the countries that they talk about. We've had a lot of guests returning from Nicaragua, and we've had Nicaraguans as well coming here and telling you about Nicaragua. We have two people who not only have been to Nicaragua various times in the past, but they also participated in the election watching process which occurred in Nicaragua recently. Carl Dahman and Hermine Dahman were part of Pastors for Peace, and they had very unique experience in their most recent trip to Nicaragua, because they were able to talk with some of the highest ministers of the Sandinista government, but they also went out into the cities and the towns and the countryside during the election, and they have a wonderful feel for what really happened. But before we talk to our guests, here are a couple of news stories from the Alternative Press.
There is a report that's ongoing from an investigation by the Houston Post, which is showing that there are links between the CIA, organized crime, and the demise of a lot of these savings and loans, particularly in Texas. They identified at least the failure of 22 of these savings and loans, including 16 in Texas. It's difficult to run down and track down the sources of information, but it's been quite extensive, the sources which they have been able to find in the Houston Post. The Justice Department says, well, we are not in a position to carry on an investigation of wrongdoing that might have something to do with national security. And the Richard Brennecke, the former CIA contract agent who's been involved in a lot of this stuff, has said that the banking and the savings and loan officials who were involved in all these, some of these schemes, were required to sign agreements, secrecy agreements with the CIA. So now nobody can talk about it or bring it up at in court cases. Of course, what was the CIA's response to all this? This is the quote of the century. Oh, we wouldn't do that. That would be a violation of U.S. laws, and we do not violate U.S. laws.
What was the CIA doing with those savings and loans? I saw a brief clip on that in CNN. Were they using those savings and loans simply to launder money or to do investments? Or
it seems that they were, through various ways, they would just get into these, and organized crime as well, they would just get into these savings and loans and then bilk them and make them go bankrupt. And the money would disappear, and of course the CIA...
They'd use it for CIA projects.
Yeah, CIA projects or the Contras or whatever else they wanted to do. The CIA has worked so long with organized crime, you know, they're real buddies, and a lot of, you know, there are some people who were both or in the Mafia and in the CIA. And so they found it easy to just bilk these savings and loans and take the money and run.
Right, that was the one thing that came out on the television, that the Contras might have been funded in part by CIA money that was bilked from these savings and loans. Oh. So it looked like that the U.S. would do anything to fund the Contras, to sell arms to the Iranians, who were the terrorists of the time, to do drug business with the Colombian cartel, to raise money for the Contras, and even to bilk American savings and loans to get more money for the Contras.
The only thing that's being done in Congress are the efforts by our old buddy Henry Gonzalez from San Antonio, who's head of the House Banking and Currency Committee. He's been investigating the S&L crisis, but the rest of the Congress, they're just leaving it alone.
Yeah. However, just today in the New York Times, in the front page of the business section, there was a lead story called Problems of Savings Bailout, Handling of Agency by Bush is Seen as Open to Criticism. The article points out that Bush's first action as president during the first 3 weeks of his tenure was to do the savings and loan bailout at the expense of American taxpayers that would be forced to pay $150 to $300 billion over the next 20 years or so to bail out the savings and loans. It passed with nary a voice of Democratic opposition because a lot of the Democrats were compromised in this scandal. Well, according to the Times, that the temper of Congress is starting to change on this, and that this was highlighted last week by the resignation of Daniel Kearney, who's the chief executive of the federal agency over that has been mandated to oversee the bailout.
The Resolution Trust.
Right, and this evidently has a lot of Congress people angry because the Bush administration wasn't really cooperating with him and wasn't really doing anything to solve the bailout.
No, they've actually been consciously dragging their feet, and they hadn't even appointed all the people necessary to do the job.
They hadn't appointed the people necessary to do the job. They were allowing the same kind of bad investments to go on, so that the bankruptcy rate has been increasing, and it's been a scandal. So,
In addition to that, from other information I have, the cost of these delays of the U.S. government having to maintain control and responsibility for all these bad debts and all is costing the taxpayers $100 billion a year.
I was happy to see a very rare criticism of our Teflon president, George Bush, in the New York Times by Anthony Lewis this week, titled The Bush Disaster. Lewis opens with the question, when has a president responded so feebly to the challenge of historical change? When has the idea of American leadership been so mocked? Lewis points out that that week in the Soviet Union, there were some of the most momentous changes in history in which the Communist Party leadership opened the way to multi-party democracy in the Soviet Union. At the same time, there were momentous events in South Africa, throughout Eastern Europe, a whole change in East-West relations that Lewis says constitute the most significant changes of our time and new opportunities for world peace and better world relations. Well, how does George Bush respond to this, Lewis asks. He goes on a tour to ask campaign or military spending. He asked Congress for new strategic nuclear weapons systems. He demands a 25% increase in the Star War budget. In fact, I was watching television all that week, and every day you'd see Bush at a military installation at the same time the Communist Party was having their historic meetings to cut back on their military establishment, and you'd see George every night with the Army people. There's also, according to Lewis, a very grotesque quality to the president's performances, a disconnection from reality. The Bush defense budget, for example, includes $12 million to put improved Lance missiles, nuclear missiles, in West Germany. But the Germans, Lewis points out, have already rejected those missiles. The German politicians are pressing to reduce nuclear deployment on their soil, and they won't accept any more missiles. There's another new military planning guide that's just been published by the Pentagon, Lewis points out, that says that we must keep unchanged our estimate of a warning time of a Warsaw Pact invasion of Western Europe and keep our nuclear missiles poised at every single capital in the Warsaw Pact as well as Moscow. Well, Lewis sarcastically asks, who should those Lance missiles be targeted at? Lech Walesa, Václav Havel? There's something unreal about the continuing strategic thinking of the Bush administration in the light of changes in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Equally ridiculous, according to an article in These Times, is Bush's budget proposals that were recently unveiled. In an article on Bush's voodoo economics, 1,000 more points of rhetoric, In These Times points out that Bush's budget for fiscal 1991 represents nothing less than a continuation of the Reagan administration's policy of reducing social expenditures at the same time that military spending is increased and at the same time producing more tax breaks and other government goodies for the rich while cutting back for social programs aimed at the poor. Although Bush claims there's going to be a cutback in military spending in the new budget, in point of fact, according to In These Times, there's going to be an increase of $1.2 billion in military spending in his new budget, including increases in funding for every new weapon system that the Pentagon has on the table, including a 65% increase for funding in the MX missile. This is the missile that has the railroad system that will have missiles going around on railroad tracks all over some state in the West. A 47% increase for the cruise missile is in the budget, a 29% increase for the B-2 bomber, and a 14% increase for the Trident submarine, and of course the 22% increase for the Star Wars defense initiative. That is a total of $17.1 billion for new weapons programs, more that's being spent on natural resources, the environment, science, technology, research, etc. So it appears that there's no difference in Bush's budgets than the Reagan budget, and that there's been no taking account of the changes in East-West relations, the lessening of pressure of the Cold War, and the need to provide a defense dividend to the U.S. Budget instead of such a heavy investment in military spending. In fact, the voodoo economics of this involve Bush's belief that he can have no new taxes, that he can have a gigantic savings and loan bailout, he can pay off a tremendous national debt, he can cut capital gains taxes for the rich, and he just doesn't need to worry that everything will balance out. If this isn't voodoo economics, what is?
We'll have time for more news from the alternative press later in the program. Now let's turn to the centerpiece of this alternative views, an interview with Carl and Hermine Dahmen, with the Pastors for Peace organization. They made an extensive trip to Nicaragua observing the elections. The whole business of the Nicaraguan elections is kind of bittersweet in a lot of ways. And you can't get a real good idea of what really happened from the regular media. They usually just talk about it as the kind of the macro view, what happened in the counting of the elections and the personalities involved. But you were out with the people, in this very surprising outcome. Can you tell us just briefly, the Pastors for Peace organization went down there, and you were there how many days this last time?
We were there for 2.5 weeks.
2.5 weeks. And you talked with some of the high ministers and got to meet them and people in the who were running the voting process as well?
Yes. The Minister of State, René Núñez, came to and talked to us, and then Miguel Descoto, Minister of Foreign Affairs. And he's a very impressive man. He's a Maryknoll priest, educated in the United States, and founder of Orbis Books. And he told us about the last 10 years, they were torturous stress because of the aggressive politics of the United States. Militarily, by founding the Contras, bombing their harbor, Corinto, in 1983, and then through a whole web of misinformation and plain lies. And he didn't know what to do about it. And so militarily, they just stayed on the defensive side. They never, although it's permitted by United Nations Charter, they never went out to them in Honduras to kill them. So, about misinformation, he invited all Americans, come and see. And many, many did. And then upsetting the neighbors and through the church, and then most of all, almost, economically. The embargo and no being permitted for any loans, not from the World Bank, IMF, Inter-American State Bank.
They completely shut it off and choked the country. Now, did you talk to some of the high ministers too? Did you?
Yes. We had, for instance, the vice president of the Supreme Electoral Council. You know, the Supreme Electoral Council is the fourth branch of the government with equal authority as the executive, the judiciary, and the legislative. And the Supreme Electoral Council consists of 5 people. 2 of them were in the governing party, the Sandinistas. 2 of them were in the opposition parties. And 1 of them was neutral. He explained the democratic aspects of this whole election process. For instance, the laws had to be changed. But since the National Assembly did not contain many of the competing opposition parties, the opposition said, we had no voice in these laws. So they asked for a national dialogue in April. That was held. New laws were passed. The opposition was still not satisfied and asked for another national dialogue in October. In August of last year. As a result of that, new laws were made and the agreement was signed by the opposition party. So here you have an element of democracy in which the minority parties still have an important voice in the regulations that come out. The same type of thing happened with the Supreme Electoral Council. They had to make all the conditions for participation by the candidates. They had to run the successful registration procedure in October of last year. They had to establish the voting tables, 4,400 of them, and made all these little rules for campaigning, for equal access to media. With these politically opposed members, they had to make 250 decisions. And Dr. Leonel Arguello told us that all except 3 of these decisions were made unanimously. And I thought, if these people can do that, then it should be possible in a new government that opposition people can work together.
Now, you saw a lot of rallies. You went to UNO rallies as
right.
well as Sandinista rallies.
On the same
rallies.
Day, we split, Carl and I. I went to Leon, and on the way, we met 50 trucks with UNO people. Trucked in into Managua, and I went to León, and 10 o'clock we were there, and there was already excitement starting, and only at 2 o'clock Daniel Ortega came and Sergio Ramirez, the vice president, on trucks, and people were so enthusiastic and was very upbeat and happiness, and it was great.
So the Sandinistas' rallies were more animated. What about UNO, UNO rallies?
Well, the UNO rally was also very animated. I think the UNO rally was about 70,000 people, whereas the later Sandinista rally was about 300,000. But there were, instead of the black and red flags of the Sandinistas, you had the blue and white flags of the UNO. And all these people were milling on the great plaza in front of the roofless cathedral. You know, the cathedral had never been restored after the earthquake of 72. And there was Violeta Chamorro came in an open white vehicle, slowly moving left and right. And she looked actually sad and worried, and I felt compassion for her. And later on in the crowd, the people saw our badges of invited election observers, and they rushed to you, and they were excited. And some of them angry, and they were telling, look, it's horrible, I have no shoes on my feet, I cannot buy enough food for my children anymore, and the war is eating us up, and I've lost a son, and I lost a father, and especially the military draft. They all want to stop the military draft. They said, I don't want to let my son go into the army, or the young boy said, I don't want to go into the army. And they all thought, we will never get rid of this war. We'll never get rid of the boycott of the United States if we do not change our government. We have to change the government, that's what they all said. So it was not so much a happy crowd, really. It was more contentious and bitter and full of bitterness for the past. There was some feeling also of against the Sandinistas for a certain resentment against arrogance, high-handedness. That was there, too.
Now, you went to the smaller towns.
Yes.
Also,
so
the rural areas.
5 days before the election, we split up in 10 groups, and our group consisted of 6 in the tiny jeep, and we went to small villages like El Sauce, Achuapa, San Juan Limay.
And now, where are they? Where are they?
They are north of Lyon, 15 kilometers from Honduras.
Okay. Oh, close. That's
yes.
Where a lot of contra
yes.
activity had
and,
been.
And they said contra scare.
Uh-huh.
So an army truck came in and soldiers were there. But we talked to priests, we talked to electoral council, and then UNO people and Sandinistas. And it's worked out the same. The priests always said the people are hungry for God's work. They have many Christian-based communities, and I'll tell you more about that.
Yes, we're aware
and
of it.
UNO people, complaints. And sometimes I had a very hard time because it was an hour of in the heat, oppressive, and then those complaints. You felt the heat. And I'm sometimes a little mischievous, and I came with my question, is reconciliation possible? And our leader said, no, not yet. So we had to hear all the complaints. And then when you went to the Sandinistas, they were proud of their accomplishment. 1,000 schools had been started and built. Healthcare centers, agricultural projects, irrigation, and they said the literacy campaign had stopped temporarily because of that Contra war, but they wanted to start it again, and they thought the election will be our solution. Now the United States will recognize us as a democracy, and they didn't guess they would lose.
Well, of course, Bush said before the election, on the eve of the election, that if the Sandinistas were returned to power or maintained power, that he would continue the economic embargo, the trade
right.
embargo. So that was, you know, another indicator. Plus, now, were the people aware that the United States was pouring millions of dollars in to fund UNO?
Very
yes.
much.
They were.
These people know, they know politics better than almost any other nation, I think.
How did they feel about this? First of all, that the U.S., who had been committing horrible war crimes against them, was funding the UNO, plus a lot of the Contra supporters were in UNO. But this didn't, the economic misery just overrode all of this?
Yes, and also the hopelessness of the draft. You know, they were fed up being heroes. They wanted to be normal people. They wanted to have a normal life. That what was I told us all the time. Now, other parties, like the Social Christian Party, for instance, they were previously in the UNO, but they had stopped, they had dropped out of the UNO because they were disgusted with the way the UNO was formed, not as an positive political entity that was striving to do something, but just as an conglomeration to win the elections for the United States. And they had withdrawn, and as a result, they are squeezed out between the polarization between the Sandinistas and the UNO. And that's tragic, because it was an, these small parties were good parties, and they presented pluralism in their ever-growing democracy. And now they are set back maybe for years.
Mm-hmm. I've read where a lot of people who were actually supporting the Sandinistas voted UNO.
Yes.
Did you run into that?
Yes. I asked afterwards many people, are you happy with the outcome? And then many mothers told me, who had been mother of a hero and martyr, so they had, their one or two sons had been killed, or their husband. And they said, I gave my vote to UNO as a present to other mothers, so their sons will not be killed.
But they still support the goals
heart,
and objectives
Sandinista,
of the Sandinistas.
But they voted for UNO.
Did you find a lot of people in the countryside who were just ordinary people who were well armed? You know, the Sandinistas gave out arms to about everybody,
no,
you know, a long time ago.
In
the
you know, just during the election days, it was strictly forbidden to have arms. During the election, it was even forbidden to wear a T-shirt for the Sandinistas, for instance. Like, one of the Sandinista election observers, when he found somebody who was wearing a T-shirt, he would send him home. Go home and get that thing out, because you're not supposed to be here.
Oh, but nonetheless, to help fight the Contra-War, they did hand out for many years.
Oh, for many years. Yes, because it was not possible to work the land without arms.
But we didn't see that, you know.
No.
Oh, I see.
During those days, no weapons were allowed on the streets.
Now, what I'm thinking of now is if UNO tries to get the general populace to turn in their arms,
they hid them for years, you know. Mm-hmm. They are afraid of those Contras because they were ruthless. They have raped and tortured and killed. And they killed mostly the church leaders, teachers, healthcare workers, or foreign workers like Ben Lindner, mm-hmm. like Mauricio, who came to our village of Achuapa and worked as a veterinarian and worked with the farmers, and he got killed. So now my lady of my little hotel said many Mauricios came from Switzerland after that to help the people.
After the election was over, it was such a shock to everybody. The accounts I've read, that there was just a sense of gloom over the country. Did you see that there?
Yes.
Was that your impression?
Very much. In the beginning, I thought that it was something that only I experienced, that I may have been mistaken, because all the way down from Esquipulas, where we were, to Managua, I asked him, I said, what are these happy victors? No, they won the elections. Nobody was smiling. Nobody was cheering. Everybody went on with stale faces, didn't talk to each other very much. All this animated discussion and goings-on what you had before the election, it was suddenly died out. I cannot explain it.
Right, and in my little village, nobody greeted us anymore. Everybody was looking down. And it was sad, really. But then, I have to tell you, we all went back to Managua. First, we started again through León, where we had to go back to and had a little luncheon there. And you talk to people, and some said, yes, I'm satisfied, I voted for UNO. But most said, I'm sad with the outcome. But, and then in Managua, we had to be Tuesday. So Sunday was the election. And Tuesday, they said, hey, there is a rally in on Plaza de la Revolución. So we went there, and there was a spontaneous rally for Daniel Ortega. And he came, and there were thousands of people. And people are so friendly there. There was a little tree here and higher up, and they said, come stand here so you can see better. And I said, I'm in your way now. And they said, oh, it doesn't matter. And then the lady, you want to see him? And she dragged me so where I could see Daniel Ortega. And he said, we are, have to be proud. We made this election possible. And we have a constitution, and we will defend this constitution with freedom to speak, freedom of meeting, and freedom of strike, and right to the good, just wages, and all that. And we'll defend it. Mm-hmm. So that gave us an uplift.
You, that was your third trip to Nicaragua,
yes.
Right? There were so many things that buzzed in my mind to think about the future of this poor country. The U.S. involvement, the bringing of the Contras, these vicious, horrible people
but
back into the government.
Maybe
UNO itself is just a coalition of 13 or 14 parties, wondering whether it can stay together. And there are so many people who, some people want to make radical changes, dismantle all of the social, political, and economic gains of the Sandinista revolution. The others want to maintain. What do you think will happen?
Well, Frank, I'm thinking of the reality in the rural communities where we are. That's where the people live. That's where the UNO people are. That's where the Sandinista people are. And you're asking yourself, will there be necessarily enemies, or can they work together? And I come back again to this extraordinary experience of the elections itself. It's almost like the elections had their own life. Yeah? It, not only the outcome was important, but the elections were so important. They said, we are going to have elections. They will be the best elections that ever have been held in the hemisphere. So they were. So these people worked together there. They learned to work together in the election process. This was wonderful. Then, in Esquipulas, where my little group was, we learned about the political strife, the UNO people complaining that they had been intimidated, the other people complaining that the UNO people were bought out with their votes. But then we saw that, for instance, in the church, there was the pastor held a mass for peace, and he introduced us as election observers. They all came to us and shook our hands and said how glad they were that we were there. Later on, I met these church people back as opposite people, opposite in the political parties, in the election rooms. And they worked together. One evening, we went to a very small hamlet, El Barro, and there was a chapel with about 120 people, the warm glow of candlelight. And they held a vigil for peace. The liturgy was entirely of their own making. The pastor just stood with his T-shirt on among the crowd. The person who was leading in prayer, he was an ardent Sandinista, he told me. And the band, who was lustily playing band, was all UNO. And all together, they were singing a song of peace. And then they separated in four groups, one to talk about peace, want to talk about justice, want to talk about love, want to talk about faith. So these people can work together. They find themselves in their common spirituality, in their common concerns for what happens in their own community, and they all learn to work together. And I think that together with what we have seen in Managua among the people in the Supreme Electoral Council and in the government and these people in the countryside, I think they have it in them. They have a tremendous capacity for forgiveness, as has already been shown in the way how they can forgive the Contras, how they can forgive the prisoners, Somocistas even, who have been released in the general amnesty. And if they are left alone, I think they will make it. They can forge against all the adversity a good society in this little country.
Well, thank you both. Let's now look at El Salvador in contrast to the democratic elections in Nicaragua and see what has happened in El Salvador from a person who lives there. Joe Berra is a Jesuit priest.
They continue. The war is continuing. I think, and it's going to continue until serious negotiations take place.
How do you appraise the U.S. role in all of this? So far, the U.S. has contributed $4 billion in military and other aid to El Salvador over the last 10 years or so since this war has been going on. And just this year, they gave $390 million in aid to El Salvador, and an extra $60 million was just released to help the government stave off the current rebel offensive. Do you see the U.S. aid as one of the main factors in keeping the war going? Has the U.S. done anything to help bring about a peaceful settlement? And what should indeed the role of the United States people and government be in this El Salvador conflict?
Well, first, I think there's a misunderstanding of what's going on. And I at least have been trying to share some of my experience with policymakers and in the press, so that the killing can stop, so that there is a settlement that's reached. I think the U.S. has to change its perspective on what's going on, that the roots go back beyond the elections that elected Cristiani. Nobody goes further back than that. They just keep saying, well, Cristiani was democratically elected, and so the only response of the U.S. is to support that.
Right.
And I think we have to go back and say the real problem is a war that's going on, elections that were held in those contexts and held used basically as an instrument also to eliminate the leftist opposition have been imperfect as a means of resolving the war.
Right.
So the real causes of the war, the injustice, the repression that took place, and we see now that those structures are still in place, that has to be addressed. One way of addressing it, once this new understanding of what's going on becomes part of U.S. policy, would be to use the military aid as a way of changing or getting the government's to clean up its act and change its position with respect
which
to negotiations.
Which hadn't worked. For 10 years, it's been the law.
In the sense of suspending it.
Right.
I guess I got it kind of caught in a circle.
Right.
But would be to halt military aid.
Okay.
And to make it U.S. policy that of working for a negotiated settlement, to take seriously whatever offers are being made on both sides, and to send signals to the Salvadoran government. Number one, we're not going to support an army that is massacring its own people.
Right.
And that, in principle, just we cannot do, I think, if we're people of principle. And secondly, that the solution we favor is a negotiated solution. That would help a lot in terms of eliminating the elements in the army and the far right who believe that the only solution is to annihilate whatever opposition there is.
Right.
So there may be hope. I think there's still hope that different forces in Salvadoran society can reach a consensus about negotiation, and including right-wing forces and the rebels and other independent groups, labor unions or popular organizations or even business organizations, if they're in favor of negotiation. They can all participate in whatever that process is of consensus building and negotiation. But what happens is that on the government side, one of the principal actors, the forces that are really in power are the ones who do not want negotiation.
Now let's return to our news stories, which we've obtained from the Alternative Press.
Does anyone remember Cold Fusion?
Not I. You know what's happened? I figured it was dead because the Aggies out at College Station said it was okay.
Well, everybody else thought it was dead, too. The story began last March when two chemists from the University of Utah, Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischman, announced that they had discovered a process in their laboratory that was carried out at room temperature in the laboratory equivalent of a mayonnaise jar. That could be a clean, virtually inexhaustible source of energy. Well, the world went crazy, especially the scientific community. In fact, at the meeting where they presented the data, Pons and Fleischmann got a standing ovation from the scientists over there, which is remarkable in a scientific
the establishment
field.
Science?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I thought they were excoriated because they didn't go through the usual rigors.
Well,
and all that.
That came later, but when they announced, everybody was excited.
Oh, I see.
Okay. But after the that first meeting, other researchers had trouble duplicating the studies. Pons and Fleischmann got kind of cagey about experimental details. They tried to publish a paper kind of prematurely that didn't have all the proper controls. And suddenly the pendulum of scientific opinion swung back on them. To show you how far, 6 weeks after their first announcement at another major scientific conference, a Caltech physicist named Stephen Koonin trumpeted, "We're suffering from the incompetence and delusions of Drs. Pons and Fleischmann. The experiment is just wrong."
But this was after the scientists at Texas A&M had duplicated or replicated it.
Exactly.
And said it was okay.
So after this meeting where Koonin trumpeted, and again the crowd cheered, by the way, which doubly unusual. After this cold fusion was considered so much dead meat. But in December, an Associated Press Wire story reported that both Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico and the Oak Ridge National Laboratories in Tennessee had confirmed the experiments of Pons and Fleischmann.
Gosh, I don't remember that being trumpeted on the media.
Well, interestingly enough, a friend of mine who was home on Christmas vacation from UT saw it in the, believe it or not, the Amarillo Globe News. Now, I went back to the I went back to the library and I looked in the New York Times, I looked in the Austin American Statesman. I couldn't find it anywhere.
My goodness.
I haven't seen anything on
this. Yeah, usually they've had these big stories on the radio and TV.
Uh-huh, well.
That's exactly. A huge story.
Exactly. Now, the part of the problem is that Pons and Fleischmann were sort of pushed into releasing their information and making their announcement a little prematurely because of the need that they and the University of Utah felt to protect their patent rights. Everybody's getting into the act here. Mm-hmm. They were afraid if they followed the usual scientific procedures of publishing their data in a journal so that their peers could review it and others could duplicate the experiment, that the process would be stolen, basically. So they were sort of pushed into this bypassing of the normal scientific procedures for presenting data. So the Energy Research Advisory Board of the DOE had done an investigation immediately after they announced their report, and their official report to Watkins at the DOE was that there was nothing in Pons and Fleischmann's data, and there should be no research thrust from DOE into cold fusion.
But don't Oak Ridge and Los Alamos, don't they work for the Department of Energy?
Exactly.
So they said, oh, it's okay, and they sent their positive statements up to their bosses, and their bosses said, uh-uh. Is that right?
That's right. Now, also, the other part of it is that the Oak Ridge data came out after the recommendation was made to drop the notion of cold fusion. So these are experiments that have been continued after the DOE has decided not to continue funding. Now, the reason that this is important is because cold fusion is a remarkable process. The idea of fusion is that two atoms smash together and they fuse, and when they do, huge amounts of energy are released. I mean, this is the process that that goes on in the sun. Now, up till now, the U.S. government has spent tens of billions of dollars on research to try and mimic the conditions that go on in the interior of the sun. In other words, to raise temperatures to millions of degrees. Now, I mean, the technological problems here are incredible. The first cut is, what container would you use to carry out a reaction at 2 million degrees centigrade? So for 30 years, the U.S. has been funding at very high levels this kind of high-tech research. Now Pons and Fleischmann come along, and they say that in their laboratory, in the equivalent of a mayonnaise jar, at room temperature, they can create fusion.
Well, I don't understand. If they can create cold fusion, the energy released is supposed to be heat, right? In order to produce heat and drive generators and make electricity.
Exactly.
How can a cold fusion do the job?
Well, what they do is, instead of trying to heat up these atoms to give them enough energy to smash into one another to fuse, they force the atoms into a metal rod made of palladium. And its structure is such that the atoms that are forced in there are driven together. And the theory is that because of the structure and because of the kinds of atoms, that fusion can take place on a microscopic scale within the structure of the metal, the palladium metal. And so all you do is the atoms that fuse are called deuterium, and this is a substance that's very common in seawater. So you take the laboratory equivalent of seawater and you stick in a palladium electrode, and you run some current in it to pull the deuterium into the metal structure, and fusion takes place. Now, Pons and Fleischmann claim that they got, in some experiments, up to 100 times the energy out that they put in. And they're saying that that was produced by the process of fusion.
Yeah.
After that, the process is easy because the water that the electrode is in heats up, and then that water can be used to drive generators, turbines, and so forth.
So it's a fairly cheap process.
Oh, it's remarkable in its simplicity.
It would be the solution to all energy problems.
It would be the
too cheap to meter.
Oh, man, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, talk about something popular. I mean, you could have a mayonnaise jar in your backyard, you know, and run the neighborhood. Run all the energy you need in the neighborhood.
And it'd wipe out all of the need for all of these nuclear power plants we have, and coal oil, and oh my gosh, they'll really try to suppress this.
I wonder why you don't hear anything about it in NBC, that's owned by General Electric, that owns some of the biggest nuclear power plants in the country,
well,
et cetera.
Interestingly enough, General Electric and Westinghouse are working with the University of Utah and have gotten their fingers into that pie. Okay. Now, there's another interesting part to this story, and that is that, as we were saying, the negative response by U.S. scientists put a real wet blanket on fusion research here in the United States. And even with the new results, most establishment scientists are real grudging about giving any validity to these data.
I bet the Japanese will jump on this.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the Japanese, when cold fusion was first announced, set up a special institute to study cold fusion. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, right around the same time, two separate teams of scientists in Japan announced that they had duplicated Pons and Fleischmann's fusion results. And Hideo Ekigami, who is the head of Japan's cold fusion team, claimed that the experiments were proof that Japan had spurted ahead in the fusion race. He said, "It seems to me that researchers in the United States are more interested in denying cold fusion. And in Japan, we're interested in trying to observe cold fusion." So it looks like we're going to drop out of this race, and the Japanese are going to have cold fusion.
Turn it over to
It's only a slight exaggeration to say that whoever controls cold fusion controls the world. I mean, it's really just a remarkable process.
Heck, you could even maybe run your cars on something like that?
Anything. And you know, with miniaturization, I mean, you could have batteries that would... I mean, The applications are mind-boggling.
Well, I have an article here that indicates that if George Bush has his way, the U.S. will give up some other high-tech competition with Japan. That Bush is unplugging all these government programs that are supporting different research into high technology fields. An article by John Judis in These Times points out the paradox that as president, Ronald Reagan talked a strong laissez-faire game, but in his second term, he sanctioned government intervention to prop up America's ailing high-tech industries and to invest government funds into research for high-definition television, different microchips, and other high-tech technologies in the electronics field that the Japanese had dominated. Well, according to recent congressional leaks to the press, it appears that George Bush, who talks a moderate Republican game, is really going all the way with laissez-faire. There's been leaks that Bush is planning to deprogram, to unfund certain of the programs supported by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency to cut down on government support for industrial research and development. Bush wants to cut funding for Semiatech, the government-backed consortium of semiconductor producers that is developing advanced methods for manufacturing computer chips. The Reagan administration had given $100 million a year to Semiatech, and Bush wants to cut it off government support altogether, which, by the way, would be very expensive for the University of Texas, Austin, and the state of Texas that spent millions of dollars to lure Semiatech here to Austin. The UT system gave $12.3 million of land free to the Semiatech consortium. The university in the city gave millions of dollars. The taxpayer is going to have to put out $56 million for support of the Semiatech industry. And it looks like if Bush refuses to give it any government support, it could be in very serious trouble. Two major high-tech consortiums have gone bankrupt in Texas recently that Bobby Inman, the former CIA guy, was in charge of. So Semiatech could also be headed for bankruptcy.
He was the head of that. He was the first head of Semiatech.
Right. Then he went over to a couple other things. Now, Bush also wants to eliminate $30 million that Congress had allocated for research into high-definition television, and administration sources say that instead the Defense Department government is going to purchase advanced imaging systems from the Japanese. The Bush administration also wants to axe funds for research into X-ray lithography that's an essential technology for producing computer chips, and to eliminate other government programs into high-tech. Well, supposedly this is exactly what the Japanese want. The Japanese are overjoyed because they then will be the ones that will control high-definition television, computer chips, and other electronics industries, and the U.S. will be out of the competition for this. Congress, however, is somewhat angry about this. There's been quite a bit of congressional anger about Bush's cutting back of these programs, and recently two reports were published that indicated that by the year 2010, if the federal government does not support high-tech industries in the U.S., the U.S. could lose 792,000 jobs in the electronics industry and over 2 million jobs altogether. And they estimate that the loss of high-definition television would contribute $227 billion annually to the U.S. trade deficit.
Wow.
1,000 points of life, you know, all this gentler world, kinder, gentler world. Well, maybe. The Dallas Morning News had a story, which was picked up by the Associated Press, that the folks in power are mucking around making studies about us third world people here in the United States, because thousands of poor people in Texas and four other states didn't know it, but they were subjects of an experiment by the federal government which denied them aid which other people were getting. And why were they denying these people the aid? Well, the federal government just wanted to see how they get along without it. Extra Medicaid and child care benefits are going to about 8,000 people in five regions in Texas, but 800 people selected at random by birth date are not going to get this help. So, as I said, the point of the study was to see how well the people would get along, you know, see if they live, see if they stay in bad health. Let's don't help them, for heaven's sakes. They're not the wealthy elite.
There's an interesting article in The Nation by Philip Berryman, a Catholic priest and activist, on arms in Panama, that points out that the first foreign visit of the new Panamanian president, Endara, was to neighboring Costa Rica, which, interestingly enough, is the most prosperous democracy in Central America, and it doesn't have a standing army. After their civil war of 1948, Costa Rica decided to abolish its army, and since then has made do with a police force. Well, Berryman said that many people in Panama and throughout Central America are trying to make this out as a model for Panama, that is, abolishing the army. The argument is that the eastern half of Panama, which borders on Colombia, is a dense, roadless jungle and is thus not subject to invasion or doesn't need any army to patrol the border. And the other border is with Costa Rica, which itself doesn't have an army, so that therefore it really isn't necessary for Panama to have an army. In fact, there's been so much revulsion against the army that was the subject of so much corruption under the Noriega regime that it makes perfect sense just simply to abolish the army and eliminate this possibility for increased corruption as well as instability, since military forces tend to be involved in coup d'etats and to destabilize countries throughout the third world. Of course, the United States is not all that keen on Panama doing away with the army, indicating that they need an army to fight against narco traffickers and possible subversion from Cuba and Nicaragua. So the U.S. so far hasn't really encouraged Panama to abolish their army, but many other forces in this region are, and that would be very interesting if they did so. Conclude our news segment today with a Dan Quayle story. We can't have any news segment without the Dan Quayle story. This is in The Progressive, titled A Heartbeat Away. A news item for the Honolulu Star Bulletin and Advertiser for December the 3rd indicated that an unnamed TV official went golfing with Dan Quayle and Jack Nicklaus last weekend. When the official asked the Veep his reaction to the situation in Czechoslovakia, Quayle glazed over and said, "What?" responded the official, "Well, the entire government was replaced. It was overthrown a couple of days ago. There's been a big democratic revolution in that country," replied Quayle. "Oh." Nicklaus piped up with a consoling, "Well, you can't be on top of everything." Right, Dan?
I wonder if he's retarded. How can anybody be that dumb?
Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We can also provide you with information on how you can obtain material by John Stockwell. We'd like to thank our crew for the production today, Brian Lynch, Ralph Ekakaitis, and Karen Vines. Brian also was the director for some of our news, and another portion of the news was done by Eric Eubank and Kevin L. West. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network. P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. That's our address if you'd like to write to us. Bye-bye.